You're listening to Congratulations Pine Tree, the Bay's number one arts and culture podcast with me, Kate Rhodes.
And me, Maysoon Wazwaz.
Maysoon, let's give a little shout out to Sarah Hotchkiss, who sent us a very nice message of appreciation for the show, and also shouted us out on Forum with Michael Krasny.
I heard that. That's amazing. Thank you, Sarah. That was so sweet of you.
Yes, thank you. And we'll put a link to Sarah's end of the year rundown of best shit of art.
Best shit of art.
And so that's phenomenal. Okay, also coming up is Outside In, work by Stacey Goodman, Gwyneth Zeleny Anderson, and Manoush Zamorodinia, curated by Sarah Klein. And this is in a favorite, okay, peephole cinema.
Oh, awesome.
A little peephole.
It's by me.
And it screens 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And it's up January 8th through March 9th. And the location of that is 280 Orange Alley off of 26th Street near Valencia, right by Maysoon's house, which we will not share the exact location of. So go check that out. We got to go to that Maysoon. Go look at it anytime you want.
I do also want to give a quick update. So Galleria de la Raza has relocated.
To where?
They relocated. So the landlords eventually decided to raise their rent, and so they had to leave their original space, which is terrible. But they're relocating to a space on my block, on Valencia, between 25th and 26th Street.
Not very far from where they were before.
Not very far from where
they were.
Still
in the Mission.
Still in the Mission. It's fucking amazing. I don't think they're quite open yet. They have to do some repairs, like painting, cleaning up, stuff like that. But this is going to be their space for the next 2 years while they're working with the city on finding their permanent space.
Thank fucking God. Okay, Maysoon, that is a mere like 10 minutes walk from their 24th Street location. Is that right? 12 minutes of a brisk walk?
It's very close. It's a couple blocks from 24th Street BART. Easy to get to, everyone.
Phenomenal. Okay, now we have a lovely interview with Nikki Green, who honestly we could have talked to for like 5 hours and still only scratched the tip of the iceberg of her incredible knowledge, wisdom, know-how, and expertise. And can't wait for you to hear it. Here it comes. Here in beautiful San Francisco talking to artist Nikki Green. Would you like me to add on any other educator, poet?
I think artist works.
Right?
Yeah.
It's pretty all-encompassing.
Yeah, totally.
Okay, my first question for you. You have a lot of mushrooms in your work, and I suspect that you have a lot of secret knowledge of mushrooms, and I just wondered if you wanted to share any of it with me and our listeners. I feel like it's mushroom season, kind of, because I've been seeing mushrooms all over my neighborhood. Am I wrong?
I think you were right. It is definitely like moist mushroom season. Yeah, I mean, I use a lot of mushrooms in my work, mostly because it feels like this motif that I had swapped a handful of years ago out for floral patterns. I had been making this kind of illustrative, kind of heavily patterned floral ceramic work. And I guess a handful of years ago, I had come across this book called The Poisonous Mushroom, which is a piece of Nazi propaganda from the 30s. Yeah, that was published in Berlin. And it's essentially just a book of anecdotes about Jewish people and how their fluctuating visibility makes them poisonous and like poisonous mushrooms, in that you can't eat every mushroom you find, just like you can't trust every person you meet because they might be Jewish and they might try to kill you. So I think...
Holy shit!
I know. It's super intense.
It's crazy.
And also, it felt like this really exciting moment to think about Jewishness and to think about queerness in this kind of parallel way that's sort of about a fluctuating visibility and sort of a complicated relationship to passing, and that way of moving through the world being poisonous. But I guess I was trying to think about, or I've been trying to think about poisonousness as this kind of potentially empowering thing. Like, what does it mean to take on poisonousness as like an identity marker? And so it's become this ongoing thing for me with my work, trying to sort of fill spaces with mushrooms and also use it as this kind of aesthetic motif, like a pattern.
What kind of mushrooms can I eat that I can find near the sidewalk?
Probably not near the sidewalk. I think that, like, foraging, that's like a question that folks ask a lot when they see the work, and they're like, oh, do you forage for mushrooms? And I mean, my instinct is like, I don't fuck with that, but that's I think that it feels so tenuous. It does feel like this really iffy thing. Like, when I look at mushroom guides and it's like, this mushroom is poisonous and this mushroom is not, and they like look really similar. I don't think I would, ever like pick something up and be like, I know for sure I can eat this. I'm going to go ahead and do it. So I would say, if you're interested in exotic mushrooms, you should go to Rainbow Grocery and
shout out to Rainbow.
check out that mushroom section.
So you have some of these mushroom works. I'm sorry, but I don't know the titles. In the show at Bay Area or YBCA Bay Area now, which you're in. Congratulations.
Thank you.
And I was looking on your website and also remembering the work on View. You know, the mushrooms are, the colors are incredible, and they're not, you know, I don't want to say psychedelic because I feel like that sounds too bright, but there's something somewhat ominous about the mixture, like the combinations of sort of bright colors kind of underneath these darker, more sort of natural colors, their forms are, at least in the work at the YBCA, it's like they don't necessarily come off right away as mushrooms. And then you're like, you're looking longer and longer trying to figure out what the object is, because they're kind of drooped over. There's sort of these sort of things you don't necessarily equate, forms that you don't equate with mushrooms, super interesting. But anyhow, maybe talk about some of that work a little bit.
Sure.
Oh, yeah. And the felt.
Yeah, all the felt was kind of...
Oh, was there felt in those pieces?
A lot of the mushrooms are sort of like resting on felt, okay, or sort of like draped onto pieces of felt. Right. There's a really tall one that has like pieces of felt kind of jammed into its seams, like where the sections of the ceramic come together. I mean, I very much think of them as figures. That was kind of a reference point from the beginning, that I wanted to make sort of large kind of body-sized mushrooms. And I guess the gestures to me are all of these kind of like bodily gestures. They're kind of, a lot of them are draping, I think, which was a desire to move away from the kind of verticality of the way that mushrooms and a lot of like organic material grows. Yeah. There's this sort of like heroic, like upward growth. And I guess I just kept thinking about like what it would feel like if that verticality stopped sort of like functioning. Like, what if these things started to sort of like droop or like fall over because of their weight, and sort of think about them as these really kind of heavy objects, heavy figures. I mean, color-wise, I think that...
I guess I should also say, it seems like it's a big shift, maybe, the color. I was thinking about color when looking at your work, because I feel like I'm familiar with some of your earlier work, where it's the white, is it porcelain?
It's not,
or white with sort of like the blue or purple, kind of more simple lines, yeah. And then you're like into this full glaze, like solid.
Yeah, I mean, for so long I had been making vessels, like pretty explicitly vessels, and working from like a Dutch Delftware tradition, thinking about like the object as the vehicle for surface work. I think I had mainly been kind of motivated by the way that Delftware has functioned both like aesthetically, but also as this kind of like history recorder. The last time I was in the Netherlands, I was at the like sort of last remaining Delftware factory in Delft. And the thing that I kept sort of coming to is like the history of the Netherlands is recorded in this ceramic material, that the ceramic wares are a product of this, you know, small industrial town. But they're also doing this sort of like, the ceramic is has this dual function. It's like also a surface to record history, like narrative history in. And so it became really clear to me that it would work really well for queer and trans history to use flat surfaces of vessels as a vehicle for illustration and pattern. And yeah, and so I feel like the mushroom work was this really intentional sort of stepping away from that and trying to think about objects and sort of sculpture in a much more like sort of direct and formal way. But I think that now, especially after having spent a handful of years like making this sculptural work, I'm now trying to figure out how these two sort of bodies of work, or these two sort of like sculptural ceramic pursuits, exist in the world together. Because I think that that's become really my primary question, is like highly patterned and illustrative vessels and then these sort of mushroom sculptures, like how do they intersect? Like, do they live in the same world? I think so, but I'm not totally sure. And I think that that's just what I'm interested in kind of exploring as I keep making work. It's just like asking these questions.
Also, ceramics last forever.
Yeah.
What about that?
Well,
that was like the big, when I was in school, you had to take ceramics if you were a fine arts major, and it really wasn't my thing at all because I don't like having dry hands.
Oh my God, it's so hard, especially this time of year where it's already so dry out. Yeah, a lot of moisturizer. It's
what really kind? Like shea butter?
Right now I'm using cocoa butter, but I've sort of like tried a lot of different stuff and nothing feels like sort of the answer. Though I imagine that lots of ceramics folks like have relationships with different moisturizers, and I've heard all of these things, like if you rinse your hands in vinegar after working with the clay, it like changes the pH of your hands and like keeps them from like cracking and getting too dry. Or if you put on moisturizer before you start working, it like sort of seals like a barrier and keeps your hands from getting too dry. I don't know if anything has really felt monumental in sort of experimenting with stuff, but yeah, I mean, dry hands is sort of like a brutal inevitability.
Do ceramicists like have like pride in their hand dryness?
I mean, I certainly don't.
That's hysterical, Kate.
I guess when I think about it too, a lot of the ceramics professors and like mentors I've had have all had kind of exceptionally not dry, sort of like, I don't know if I would say moist, but just like very well moisturized hands. And I imagine it's maybe just a like a consistency, like keeping up like a moisturizing regimen.
Did you work with Aaron Toole at all?
I did, yeah.
I feel like he has very supple hands.
Yeah, I agree. John DeFazio as well is somebody that I worked with through undergrad. And I just have this very distinct memory of him having very soft hands. Yeah, like noteworthy soft hands.
But anyhow, so my weird teacher at undergrad would try to suck people into ceramics by saying, hey, this is archival. It will last through millennia. Your painting's going to be a fucking mess in 1,000 years.
Yeah, totally.
Is that relevant to you as an artist?
Was that one of the reasons why you went into ceramics?
I don't know if it's one of the reasons why I went into ceramics, but it's certainly a detail that I continue to think about. I think if anything, it's stressful to think about work existing forever. You know, like this shitty work that I'm making is going to like never break down and will yeah, will always exist, even if it's in the background, even if it's like sitting collecting dust in my storage unit, it's like still gonna be there. For me, like when I'm thinking about queer history, say, there's this really important detail that what is recorded in ceramic will outlast my body and will outlast future generations of queer people. And so, you know, there's this very sort of forward-looking thing about like what's important about queerness now and what's important about queerness in the past that maybe didn't get recorded in a kind of immediate and kind of direct way that really should be immortalized in clay. And so, I mean, I think that there's something really empowering about that. Yeah, it's sort of archival quality. Yeah, but I mean, I definitely think that like in terms of accumulation of stuff, it's like a little depressing to think about these things never breaking down.
So I want to hear a little bit about Peter Volkus's kiln. And sure. are you still working with those bricks? Is that still like a part of your, I mean, I guess that wasn't that long ago, really. It was during your grad years, right?
Yeah, I did that body of work while I was in grad school at UC Berkeley. And it was really like an incidental body of work, just in that, you know, Volkus had designed the ceramics facilities that are at Berkeley now and had these kind of like legendary doodly cohorts at Berkeley prior to my being there. And I came in at this kind of funny time in Berkeley ceramics history where there hadn't been like a lot of ceramics action for many, many years. And Volkus's kilns have just been kind of sitting there, like Aaron Toole's been, you know, storing a lot of his cups in the sort of non-functional kilns, and they just kind of exist as these relics. It's very haunting and kind of beautiful, the way that they sort of have just sat there and collected dust. So I think like when I came into the program, I was really like, okay, this is this example of the way that, say, art world misogyny exists, and say ceramics misogyny exists, or misogyny in the ceramics world or ceramics community. These kilns are these sort of like icons of that way of working with material and being sort of in community around like specific materials. What does it mean as like a trans woman to like walk into this space and be making work in this space as well? Like, would I have been able to be part of this cohort, you know? And I think that my misandrist instinct is to be like, of course not. And you know, these people would have hated me and I would have never been able to make work here. So like, haha, you know, like, but I think that it also became really important to not make assumptions about like how I would have operated in that space, because there's really no way to know. You know, I'm making like pretty large scale work, which is what Volkus was making and teaching at the time. And like, who knows how he would have felt about somebody like me in that space. And like, how useful is it to sort of like feed that revenge fantasy? So, yeah, I mean, I think a lot of the work just became about like speculation and mostly sort of like archiving materials, like sort of collecting things and thinking about the weight that they hold as sort of historical objects. And so for this show at Fuse Space, which is, you know, very much about sort of like California and art making. Margaret Tedesco like asked me to show this work specifically, which was really exciting because the work had only existed in my studio at UC Berkeley and contextually really only made sense to me in like UC Berkeley facilities. And so it was really exciting to have this opportunity to bring it out of the studio and to think about it as work that gets to ask these same questions and kind of exist in a different, maybe more neutral context. Yeah, it's been really fun. And I ended up doing a performance lecture, like writing a paper, which is really, I would say, like looking at images of these kilns and this sort of space and asking these objects questions, like these sort of big questions about what it means to inherit this kind of legacy. And I gave that performance lecture at CAA last winter, and I'm going to be giving it again on January 9th at Fuse Space, like in conjunction with the show, which is going to be really interesting. It's been like, you know, a good year since I've kind of given that lecture and sort of really sort of dug into that material again. So it'll be exciting to do that and sort of see how it feels.
And that is on 16th Street, right by CCA.
Totally.
And I listened to that lecture, and you refer to yourself yourself as a soft brick.
Totally.
Which I'm still trying to wrap my head around, but I'm definitely fascinated or interested in it. And at one point you talk about how, you know, there's codes within the queer community that is kind of like special, like language between it's not necessarily for everyone to completely understand. And so I was like, I might be that person who doesn't completely understand, which is totally fine. But I wanted to ask about this notion of the brick.
So in the context of this text that I wrote, I'm referring to this piece of trans vernacular that specifically refers to trans women who don't pass as cis women. And it's really used only within the trans community. And I had actually never even really heard it vocalized until really recently, when I was watching that TV show Pose, and one of the characters after a ball like turns to another character and says like, "Bye bye, Brick," and I was like, oh my god, this is like this reference to this word sort of in popular culture, which I had never really heard sort of beyond. Really, my computer is sort of like where I had found it. There's this kind of archaic, and I guess still functioning, database that was very kind of important to me growing up as like a baby trans person, called TS Roadmap. It's like this really kind of difficult to stomach. It's a database of material around transition for like sort of trans women sort of spectrum people. And it's, you know, specifically things like, here are details around what you need, bureaucracy wise to like transition. Like here are, you know, all of the electrologists in your like general area. And then the big thing that feels sort of, iconic and also really difficult to continue to sort of like process is a database of like quote unquote trans successes, which are like sort of bios of trans women who are like successful, meaning like pass as cis and have some kind of success in the world in sort of like a mainstream way, which is mostly like normatively beautiful trans women who work as like showgirls or a lot of like performers, which is like valid. But, you know, I think like as a young trans person, you know, sort of coming to terms with my transness in like the late 90s, early 2000s, it's intense to really be thinking about sort of what success means and to maybe take on the complicatedness of normative beauty and to sort of anchor success in passing and desirability, I guess. So anyway, that's all to say, there's also a list of vocabulary, like trans vocabulary, and this is where I found brick as like a young person. I think as an adult, I had been, I guess I had been working with bricks mostly through this kind of language of ceramics. Like I had been making, so I guess this is like 2010, 2011, was making a body of work that's sort of these like ornamented riot tools. I kept thinking about like, you know, if queer people designed the tools that would be brought to riots, like what would they look like? Could I be the person who makes the, you know, floral Molotov cocktails that get thrown during a riot? And I had realized at one point that a brick is this kind of perfect riot weapon because it's designed to be laid by hand. So it fits in the hand really perfectly. It's a building tool. So it's really heavy in order to be kind of like rigid enough to like build a structure out of. And so it like breaks glass really easily. And so I started glazing bricks with these sort of like floral patterns or with these kind of like narrative illustrations on them, and sort of thinking about like what a queer designed brick as a riot tool would look like. And from there I started to realize, I guess, that a brick has this kind of parallel to transness, and to specifically like a non-passing transness, which I think is really exciting to think about, you know, as somebody with a really complicated relationship to passing. I mean, I don't know what trans person doesn't have a kind of complicated relationship to passing, but I think to work with a brick and to think about the brick as this kind of icon of visibility is really exciting to me. And as I started to do research and dig into this work around Vulcus, I realized that the materials that I was collecting were soft brick. It's what the kiln is built out of, these super light, like porous fire bricks.
And what are those made out of?
I would want to look that up. Yeah.
Also, what are like typical building bricks made out of?
Earthenware. It's like, it's clay. Yeah.
Do you ever see ones like sometimes in different buildings in Chinatown in Oakland, some of them are kind of like weird. And then I found out that after the big fire that they repurposed some of the bricks that were in the fire, and they got kind of like, some of them have like bulges coming out
and craggy,
like,
and yeah.
That a thing? We can also come back to that.
I mean I think that the weathering on bricks is really exciting to me, and the fact that, you know, these soft bricks are meant to withstand thousands and thousands and thousands of degrees of heat was really fascinating to me. So, you know, thinking about these building tools that I was collecting at Berkeley that had been the insulators of these kilns that had built these massive sculptures that Vulcus was making, that really kind of changed the landscape of the ceramics world in relationship to like the larger art world. I guess I just kept thinking, like, what about these bricks, you know? What does it mean to be the thing that has to receive the sort of violence of the kiln over and over and over again and be asked to perform over and over, like, do that insulating to make it possible to for Vulcus to make these sculptures? Yeah, and I guess I was just thinking a lot about, like, what does it mean to be the tool, like the thing or the person that is visible and is therefore doing the kind of work every day of like, say, combating the sort of reality of being a trans person in the world, like receiving all of the transphobia because they're visible? And is there sort of a parallel between these like ways of being in the world to have realized that this idea of the brick, which is very much part of the trans community and the sort of language that's developed within the community about the community, also has this kind of through line to the ceramics world, because it sort of links my interests and links the worlds that I sort of move through, or the communities that I move through.
So what is the ceramic scene in the Bay Area like now?
I mean, I think that the ceramic scene in the Bay has continued to be substantive, you know, like there's a lot of folks doing exciting work in the Bay in ceramics. And I think that we have a really substantial history here, like a really rich history beyond just Vulcus. Like Viola Frey is somebody who constantly looking towards. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think it's great. I think ceramics is also just kind of like nationally, maybe even like internationally, kind of like having a moment right now. You know, I just feel like everybody is jumping in to like learn how to throw and make dishware. And it's great. I think that like a wider literacy in ceramics is like a wonderful thing.
Especially when the apocalypse comes.
Totally. We're going to have a lot, like a lot of, you know, like speckled dishware after the apocalypse. Oh my God, guys. Yeah.
Yes.
Because it's all going to survive, you know? Yes. Like, yes. That's the thing. This moment of, you know, widespread excitement around ceramics is going to be very apparent after the apocalypse, because we're just going to have this abundance of dishware.
So you're hand forming or hand building?
Hand building, yeah.
Does that also require firing? I assume it does.
Yeah, it does.
So how big do kilns get?
Kilns get...
Is that the only way to fire something, is in a kiln?
You can put it in a fire on the beach.
Totally.
Raku?
Yeah, raku is... So raku is a tradition where you're firing the work up to a specific temperature, and then while it's still hot, putting it in organic, like kind of burnable materials, and the kind of smoking of those materials create kind of surface onto the ceramic objects. I mean, a kiln is technology for bringing clay to a specific temperature, right? So there are these like
cones,
right? Which are the objects that are used to determine what the internal temperature of the kiln is. They are cone-shaped objects that are formulated to bend at certain temperatures. So you have a little peephole in the kiln, and when the cone starts to bend, you know you've hit whatever temperature. Yeah. But, you know, I mean, a kiln is this technology that allows us to control the temperature of the fire, or the, you know, heat in the case of like an electric kiln, just more efficiently. Mm-hmm. But, you know, for hundreds, thousands of years, people are putting clay into, you know, wood fires, and, you know, using that as their technology. So it's like, a kiln is just a really specific way of, and a really pretty, widespread way of, working with heat, I guess.
But you gotta heat it up to make it less brittle.
Yeah.
So they make huge kilns. Because your work is not, it's not small.
No.
Let's say that. Was the work...
Are you making it in pieces and then putting it together?
Sorry. Was the work that you made in for Bay Area Now the biggest you had ever worked?
Yeah, for the most part. I would say, like, one of the pieces in that show is just slightly taller than my body, like, standing up, and that's pretty much the biggest that I've worked. I've been working in sections, like sort of a lot of the work has been like building an object as a like enormous single thing, and then cutting it apart before it's dry, and then firing it, and then sort of getting to reassemble it. I sort of think of it as like Viola fraying the work, which is very much what she was doing for a lot of her work, like building these massive figures as single objects and then cutting it apart afterwards. Mm-hmm. But I think like what's so exciting to me about that, about the sort of working in sections, it means that I don't have to have a big kiln to fire it. And if it remains in sections, like if it doesn't get like epoxied together or something afterwards, it gets to move in a much more sort of fluid way through space. I don't need like a forklift to move it. I can just pick up the sections. Like I was dropping work off at Berkeley today, actually, to fire. And it's like, you know, a single piece that I delivered in like 15 sections. Like it's tedious, but it means I don't need a massive kiln. That said, you know, a kiln is essentially just, I mean, not just, but a kiln is essentially a box of soft brick, you know, as a way to insulate the interior. So they can be built however big one wants them to be. There's a quite large one at Berkeley, or there's a few quite large ones at Berkeley. A lot of Volkis's kilns that are still at Berkeley are massive, and I hear very inefficient, but massive nonetheless.
That freaks me out.
It's intense, yeah. I mean,
the size, like the massiveness?
Just one that's so, like, there's one at SFAI that I could walk into, and mm-hmm. that really freaks me the fuck out.
Yeah. I mean, it's really intense. I kind of love it. There's something, like, so wild, yeah, to see this, like, massive thing. I would be lying if I said I didn't think a lot about a gas kiln that one can walk into as akin to some kind of gas chamber. Yeah. I mean, it's literally what it is, you know, like a room with gas burners in it. It's super intense, but I think that like, it's really, there's something really exciting about it when it becomes not just like an object, but it becomes like a room, you know, like the kiln becomes this like space that is much bigger than your body, and you can walk into it and have a relationship to it in a really different way than sort of like something small that you can like put your arms around or whatever.
So you have a piece in the bay in the show YBCA that is made in sections and has the like nuts and bolts all holding it together. And I was really interested in your choice to have like all this apparatus on the outside that shows you that this is in separate sections and this is like all the accoutrement holding it together. But then you look inside and it's like one complete whole.
I had been making these objects that were, you know, the objects, the vessels that I had mentioned before that are these sort of like small kind of like tabletop sized vessels where the exterior is this kind of ornately painted surface. And I've been researching this Jewish ritual called mikveh for a long time, which is this kind of water immersion. And I guess I've been thinking about like the bathtub or like the pool as this ceramic vessel. And so that piece in particular, I kept thinking about like, what is it to glaze the interior to do this kind of ornate glaze work on the interior of a vessel rather than the exterior. Who is that for? Who is the glaze work for? In my mind, it's very much for, say, the person who's inside the pool, like using the ritual object as opposed to the people outside sort of like witnessing. But I do think that this idea of like the construction of the object is really fascinating to me. And
it's like so delicate.
Thanks. I mean, I don't know if I think of it as delicate as much as I guess ceramics is a delicate material.
Well, I was just going to say, it's nice because on the exterior, you can really see like your hand in the clay. Like it's not this like pristine, smooth surface. And then you also see the nuts and bolts. It's like, I think it's really provocative just sort of thinking about why you're showing that versus having that glorious inside be the, you know, be the thing you see maybe first, or
like say with like Viola Frey's work, you know, so much of her work are these, what I think of is very kind of imprecisely crafted figures. There's this kind of wonkiness about the figure she makes, which I really love and really kind of deeply identify with, that kind of like wonkiness. Yeah. And I found myself really drawn to thinking about what the interiors of those objects looked like. And that became this big question, like, how are these things being made? What is the process for assembling an object like that? And so I think, like, I've been really interested in trying to explore what it means for an object to, like, reveal its process. You know, what does it mean that you can see the way that this thing has been put together, and it's not, like, pretending that it's just this magical assembled immersion pool that just like exists in the world. Like the reality is that this thing was brought in like many sections and held in place by many hands and like bolted together. And there's this kind of process of making that I think is really exciting, maybe even more exciting than the object itself, like as a kind of finished thing. Yeah.
I love that.
Thanks.
In your work in YBCA, there's the river and the moons and all of these things. And I know religion or Judaism plays into that. And so I wonder if you could talk a little bit about how that is influencing your work today, or how it, if it's always done or not.
Yeah. I mean, I think that these things have always been really interesting to me, these like specific symbols, wonky hands in particular, kind of like weird, kind of creepy, delicate fingers and stuff have always been really like appealing to me. And so, you know, beyond that, I think that the sort of gesture, the image of like kind of a hand gesture, is there's something kind of tender and like warm about that. And in Jewish practice, there's this thing called the priestly blessing, which is the Vulcan hand like symbol. I didn't watch Star
like
Trek.
Like live long and prosper.
Yeah.
You got your index and middle together on one side and ring finger and pinky on the other, making a V.
Yeah, so that gesture was taken from the Jewish priestly blessing. Okay. So there are these kind of like...
Right,
yeah. Was Leonard Nimoy Jewish?
Yeah, totally.
Did he come up with that? Mm-hmm. I mean, to put it in the show, I mean.
Yeah, what...
Cool.
What I read was that they needed like a... They needed some kind of gesture, like some kind of physical way to express the like Vulcan greeting. And Leonard Nimoy had the priestly blessing, the sort of hand gesture as a child, like growing up, like going to synagogue and sort of suggested it. And it became this kind of iconic thing around Star Trek, but its origin is Jewish practice, which is amazing.
I had no idea.
Yeah. But I think it's things like that, these sort of like, maybe not even just like Jewishness, but the kind of like the gesture or the sort of like the offering of the hands becomes this kind of like beautiful way of being in relationship to ritual and prayer and the body. And so I use these kind of like hand images of hand gestures a lot in the kind of surface work that I've done. Yeah, I mean, I think that similarly to this idea of like the brick, to me, there's this idea of the compiling of symbols as this way of creating kind of like language or like visual language that has this complicated thing around like literacy, like, do you understand what I'm offering? Is it important that one understands what I'm projecting forward? Can it exist as just like, you know, an image of hands? Mm-hmm. You know, do you have to know what this means? Mm-hmm. So there is like a lot of symbols and a lot of sort of piling of symbols using conceptually loaded images in like a kind of like pattern making that I find really compelling. You know, I'm using them because I know what they mean, and there's something compelling to me about the way that they are in relationship with each other, but I don't know if it feels deeply important for somebody else to like completely understand that.
We always ask interviewees at the end of an interview if there's anything else you would like listeners to know, like if we didn't mention something that you really wanted to talk about, or if you want to shout out anything you've got coming up to let people know to go to it.
Yeah, so on January 9th, I'll be giving this performance lecture, Soft Brick, at Fuse Space in San Francisco. And then
Time is that out of the day?
6 o'clock, I think.
Evening.
Evening, yeah. And then like 3 days later, I'll be leaving for snowy Sheboygan, Wisconsin.
Oh, for the Kohler?
Yeah, to go do a residency at the Kohler factory.
Are you going to make the biggest thing of all time?
I'm going to make the biggest toilet of all time.
Like bigger than Dune Kaneko ceramics?
I don't know. Yeah.
Ceramic skyscraper.
Is that going to be fancy? Sounds like it's going to be fancy.
I mean, it's a factory residency, so the I'm really excited about it. It's going to be a really fun 3 months in Wisconsin, but I'll be back and forth between Sheboygan and the Bay, particularly a show at the CCA Hubble Street Galleries that I'm doing with Jordan Resnick and Craig Calderwood, and that show's called Trans Ecologies. Okay. And that opens, well, the show starts on February 18th and runs for a month. I think the opening date is still TBD, but so a bunch of stuff.
Yay, wicked.
Yeah.
Can't wait. Okay, well, thank you so much for speaking with us today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And as always, congratulations. Okay, Maysoon, if the people want to give us a call or a message about anything they've heard here or anywhere, they can call 419-351-6606, or they can text that number. They can email us, congratulationspinetree@gmail.com. They can tweet us at Pine Tree Podcast. We still got our Facebook page. How's that going?
That's going. I have a little fairy godmother who's been posting the episodes. It's kind of amazing.
Yeah. I quit again. Okay. So get back on there. But I did change it. If anybody wants to get in there, I made a original, Kate Rhodes original image up top. Check it out. I made it in Photoshop. Okay.
I did want to say people should, if you want to send us in, send in your favorites of 2018. Favorite shows, favorite anything, best of, too late.
Why? I don't want to do my favorites.
We're not going to do our favorites?
No.
Okay.
We can each do one favorite. Arts and culture things of the Bay Area.
That's right.
Go ahead and do it. Send it in. Congratulationspinetree@gmail.com. Okay, Maysoon, I'll be seeing you from the bridge.
To the other bridge.
To the island in between. This has been
Congratulations Pine Tree!